to return to Iquitos for my research data and then to leave the country myself. I told him the details of what had happened to Will and myself after leaving Vicente, especially the shooting on the ridgetop. "Damn," he said. "And you're still fooling around with this thing?" His statement jarred my confidence, but I said, "Look, if we do nothing, the government is going to suppress the manuscript completely. The world will be denied its knowledge, and I think the insights are important."
"Important enough to die for?" he asked.
The sound of vehicles attracted our attention. The trucks were driving across the valley toward us. "Oh, shit," he said. "Here they come." Before we could move, we heard the sound of vehicles approaching from the other direction as well.
"They've surrounded us," Phil shouted.
He looked panicked. I ran to the truck and dumped the basket of food into a small pack. I took the folders containing the manuscript and placed them in the pack as well, then thought better of it and pushed them under the seat instead. The sounds were growing louder, so I ran across the road to my right in the direction Phil had headed. Down the slope, I could see him and the other men huddled behind a group of rocks. I hid with them. My hope was that the military trucks would pass and keep going. My truck was out of sight. Hopefully, they would think, as I did, that the other cars were abandoned. The trucks approaching from the south arrived first and, to our horror, stopped even with the vehicles.
"Don't move! Police!"
a voice shouted. We froze as several soldiers walked up from behind us. All were heavily armed and very cautious. The soldiers searched us thoroughly and took everything, then forced us to walk back to the road. There, dozens of soldiers were searching the vehicles. Phil and his companions were taken and placed in one of the military trucks, which quickly drove away. As he rode past me, I caught sight of him. He looked pale and ghostly. I was led on foot in the opposite direction and asked to sit near the crest of the hill. Several soldiers stood near me, each carrying an automatic weapon on his shoulder. Finally, an officer walked over and tossed the folders containing my copies of the insights on the ground at my feet. On top of them, he threw the keys to Father Carl's truck.
"Are these copies yours?" he asked.
I looked at him without answering.
"These keys were found on you," he said. "Inside the vehicle, we found these copies. I ask you again, are they yours?"
I don't think I'll answer until I see a lawyer," I stammered. The remark brought a sarcastic smile to the officer's face. He said something to the other soldiers and walked away. The soldiers directed me to one of the jeeps and into the front seat by the driver. Two other soldiers sat in the back seat, their weapons ready. Behind us, more soldiers climbed aboard a second truck. After a short wait, both vehicles headed north into the valley. Anxious thoughts filled my mind. Where were they taking me? Why did I put myself into this position? So much for the preparation the priests had given me, I hadn't lasted a day. Back at the crossroads, I had been so certain I had chosen the correct road. This route was the one most attractive. I was sure of it. Where did I make my mistake? I took a deep breath and attempted to relax, wondering what would happen now. I would plead ignorance, I thought, and present myself as a misguided tourist meaning no harm. I just got mixed up with the wrong people, I would say. Let me go home. My hands were resting in my lap. They were shaking slightly. One of the soldiers sitting behind me offered a canteen of water, and I took it, though I could not drink. The soldier was young, and when I handed the canteen back to him, he smiled without a trace of malice on his face. The image of Phil's panicked look flashed across my mind. What would they do with him? The thought occurred to me that meeting Phil on that hilltop had been a coincidence. What was its meaning? What would we have talked about had we not been interrupted? As it was, all I did was stress the manuscript's importance, and all he did was warn me about the danger here and counsel me to get out before being captured. Unfortunately, his advice had come too late. For several hours, we rode without anyone speaking. The terrain outside grew progressively more flat. The air warmed. At one point, the young soldier handed me an open can of sea rations, something like beef hash, but again, I couldn't force anything down. After sunset, the light faded quickly. I rode along without thought, staring straight ahead with the truck's headlights. Then I slipped into a restless sleep, during which I dreamed of being in flight. I was running desperately from an unknown foe amid hundreds of huge bonfires, certain that somewhere was a secret key that would open the way to knowledge and safety. In the middle of one of the giant fires, I saw the key. I darted in to retrieve it. I jerked awake, sweating profusely. The soldiers glanced at me nervously. I shook my head and leaned against the truck's door. For a long time, I looked out the side window at the dark shapes of the landscape, fighting the urge to panic. I was alone and under guard, heading into blackness, and no one cared about my nightmares. About midnight, we pulled up to a large, dimly lit building constructed of cut stone and two stories high. We walked along a walkway past the front entrance and entered a side door. Steps led down to a narrow hall. The inner walls were also of stone, and the ceiling was constructed of large timbers and rough-cut planks. Bare bulbs hanging from the ceiling lit our way. We walked through another door and then into an area of cells. One of the soldiers who had disappeared caught up with us and opened one of the cell doors and motioned for me to enter. Inside were three cots, a wooden table, and a vase of flowers. To my surprise, the cell was very clean. As I walked in, a young Peruvian, no more than 18 or 19 years old, looked at me meekly from behind the door. The soldier locked the door behind me and walked away. I sat down on one of the cots as the young man reached over and turned up an oil lamp. When the light hit his face, I noticed that he was an Indian. "Do you speak English?" I asked.
"Yes, some," he said.
"Where are we?"
"Near Pulkupa."
"Is this a prison?"
"No, everyone here is for questioning about the manuscript."
"How long have you been here?" I asked. He looked up at me with shy brown eyes.
2 months."
"What have they done to you?"
"They try to make me disbelieve the manuscript and tell about others who have copies."
"How?"
"By talking to me."
"Just talking, no threats?"
"Just talking,"
he repeated. "Have they said when they will let you go?"
"No."
I paused for a moment and he looked at me questioningly.
"Were you caught with copies of the manuscript?"
he asked. "Yes, were you?"
"Yes, I live near here, in an orphanage. My headmaster was teaching from the manuscript. He allowed me to teach the children. He was able to escape, but I was captured."
"How many insights have you seen?" I asked.
"All that have been found," he said. "You?"
I've seen all but the 7th and 8th insights. I had the 7th, but I didn't get a chance to read it before the soldier showed up." The young man yawned and asked,
"Can we sleep now?"
"Yeah," I said absently. "Sure." I laid on my cot and shut my eyes, my mind racing. What should I do now? How had I let myself be caught? Could I escape? I concocted several strategies and scenarios before I finally drifted off to sleep. Again, I dreamed vividly. I was searching for the same key, but this time I was lost in a deep forest. For a long time I had been walking aimlessly, wishing for some sort of guidance. After a while, a huge thunderstorm came and flooded the landscape. During the deluge, I was washed down a deep ravine and into the river, which was flowing in the wrong direction and threatening to drown me. With all my might, I fought against the current, struggling for what seemed like days. Finally, I was able to pull myself from the torrent by clinging to the rocky shoreline. I climbed up the rocks and along the sheer cliffs that bordered the river, ascending higher and higher and into ever more treacherous areas. Although I had summoned all my willpower and expertise to negotiate the cliffs, at one point I found myself clinging perilously to the rock face, unable to proceed any further. I looked down at the terrain below me. In shock, I realized that the river I had been fighting flowed out of the forest and gently up to a beautiful beach and meadow. In the meadow, surrounded by flowers, was the key. Then I slipped and fell, screaming down and down until I hit the river and sank. I sat up quickly in my cot, gasping for air. The young Indian, apparently already awake, walked over to me.
"What is wrong?"
he asked. I caught my breath and looked around, realizing where I was. I also noticed that the room had a window and that it was already light outside. "Just a bad dream," I said. He smiled at me, as though he was pleased at what I said.
"Bad dreams have the most important messages," he commented.
"Messages?" I asked, getting up and putting on my shirt. He looked embarrassed at having to explain.
"The 7th insight talks of dreams," he said.
"What does it say about dreams?"
"It tells how to,
interpret dreams?"
"Yes."
"What does it say about that?"
"It says to compare the story of the dream to the story of your life."
I thought for a moment, unsure of what that instruction meant. What do you mean, compare stories? The young Indian could barely look me in the eye.
Do you want to interpret your dream?
I nodded and told him what I had experienced. He listened intently, then said,
Compare parts of this story with your life.
I looked at him. Where do I start?
At the beginning. What are you doing at the beginning of the dream?
I was searching for a key in a forest.
How did you feel?
Lost.
Compare this situation to your real situation.
Maybe it does relate, I said. I'm looking for some answers about this manuscript and I'm damn sure feeling lost.
And what else is happening to you in real life?
He asked. I've been caught, I said. In spite of everything I tried to do, I've been locked up. All I can hope for now is to talk someone into letting me go home.
You are struggling against being caught.
Of course.
What happened next in the dream?
I fought against the current.
Why?
He asked. I began to pick up on where he was headed, because at the time I thought it would drown me.
And if you hadn't fought the water?
It would have carried me to the key. What are you saying? That if I don't fight against this situation, that I might still get the answers I want? He looked embarrassed again.
I'm not saying anything. The dream is saying.
I thought for a moment. Was this interpretation correct? The young Indian looked up at me, then asked,
If you had to experience the dream again, what would you do different?
I wouldn't resist the water, even though it looked as though it might kill me. I would know better.
What is threatening you now?
I guess the soldiers, being detained.
So what is the message to you?
You think the message of the dream is to look at this capture positively? He didn't answer. He only smiled. I was sitting on my cot, leaning back against the wall. The interpretation excited me. If it was accurate, it would mean that I hadn't made a mistake at the crossroads after all, that this was all part of what should be happening.
What is your name? I asked.
Pablo, he said. I smiled and introduced myself, then briefly told him the story of why I was in Peru and what had happened. Pablo was sitting on his cot, his elbows resting on his knees. He had short, black hair and was very thin.
Why are you here? He asked.
To find out about this manuscript, I replied.
Why specifically?
He asked again. To find out about the seventh insight, and to find out about some friends, Will and Marjorie, and I guess to find out why the church is so against the manuscript.
There are many priests here to talk to, he said.
I thought about his statement for a moment, then asked, What else does the seventh insight say about dreams? Pablo told me that dreams come to tell us something about our lives that we are missing. Then he said something else, but instead of listening, I started to think about Marjorie. I could see her face clearly in my mind, and I wondered where she might be. Then I saw her running up to me, smiling. Suddenly, I became aware that Pablo was no longer talking. I looked over at him. Sorry, my mind was wandering, I said.
What were you saying?
That is all right, he replied.
What were you thinking about?
Just a friend of mine. It was nothing. He looked as though he wanted to press the question, but someone was approaching the cell door. Through the bars, we could see a soldier sliding back the bolt lock.
Time for breakfast, Pablo said.
The soldier opened the door and motioned with his head for us to walk into the hall. Pablo led the way down the stone corridor. We proceeded to a stairway and up one flight of stairs to a small dining area. Four or five soldiers stood at the corner of the room, while several civilians, two men and a woman, waited in line to be served. I stopped, not believing my eyes. The woman was Marjorie. Simultaneously, she saw me and covered her mouth with her hand, her eyes opening wide with surprise. I glanced at the soldier behind me. He was walking toward the other military men in the corner, smiling nonchalantly and saying something in Spanish. I followed Pablo as he led us across the room and to the end of the line. Marjorie was being served. The two other men took their trays to a table, talking. Several times, Marjorie gazed over and met my eyes, struggling not to say anything. After the second glance, Pablo guessed that we knew each other and looked at me questioningly. Marjorie carried her food to a table, and after being served, we walked over and sat with her. The soldiers were still talking among themselves, seemingly oblivious to our movements.
God, I'm glad to see you, she said. How did you get here?
I hid for a while with some priests, I replied. Then I left to find Will and was captured yesterday. How long have you been here?
Since they found me on the ridge, she said.
I noticed Pablo was looking at us intensely, and I introduced him to Marjorie.
I guessed that this must be Marjorie, he said.
They talked briefly, then I asked Marjorie, what else has happened?
Not much, she said. I don't even know why I'm being detained. Every day I've been taken to one of the priests or to one of the officers for questioning. They want to know who my contacts were at Vicente and if I know where any other copies are. Over and over again.
Marjorie smiled and looked vulnerable, and when she did, I felt another strong attraction to her. She looked at me sharply out of the corner of her eyes. We both laughed quietly. A period of silence followed as we ate our food, and then the door opened and in walked a priest, dressed formally. He was accompanied by a man appearing to be a high-ranking military officer.
That's the head priest, Pablo said.
The officer said something to the soldiers who had snapped to attention, and then he and the priest walked across the room toward the kitchen. The priest looked directly at me, our eyes meeting for a long second. I looked away and took a bite of food, not wanting to attract attention. Both men continued through the kitchen and out a door there.
Was that one of the priests you talked to? I asked Marjorie.
No, Marjorie said. I've never seen him. I know that priest, Pablo said. He arrived yesterday. His name is Cardinal Sebastian.
I sat up straight. That was Sebastian?
It sounds like you've heard of him, Marjorie said.
I have, I replied. He's the main person behind the church's opposition to the manuscript. I thought he was at Father Sanchez's mission.
Who is Father Sanchez? Marjorie asked.
I was about to tell her when the soldier who had escorted us walked over to the table and motioned for Pablo and me to follow.
Time for exercise, Pablo said.
Marjorie and I looked at each other. Her eyes revealed an inner anxiety.
Don't worry, I said.
I'll talk to you at the next meal. Everything will be fine. As I walked away, I wondered if my optimism was realistic. These people could make any of us disappear without a trace at any time. The soldier guided us into a short hall and through a door that led to an outside stairway. We walked down to a side yard which was surrounded by a tall rock wall. The soldier stood by the entrance. Pablo nodded for me to walk with him around the borders of the yard. As we walked, Pablo bent down several times to pick some of the flowers growing in beds by the wall.
What else does the Seventh Insight say? I asked.
He bent down and picked another flower.
It says that not only dreams guide us, also, thoughts or daydreams guide us.
Yes, Father Carl said that. Tell me how daydreams guide us.
They show us a scene, a happening, and this is an indication that this event might happen. If we pay attention, then we can be ready for this turn in our lives.
I looked at him. You know, Pablo, an image came to me that I would run into Marjorie. Then I did. He smiled. A chill went up my spine. I must indeed be in the right place. I had intuited something that had come true. I had thought several times of finding Marjorie again, and now it had happened. The coincidences were taking place. I felt lighter. I don't have thoughts like that happen very often, I said. Pablo looked away, then said,
The Seventh Insight says that we all have many more such thoughts than we realize. To recognize them, we must take an observer position. When a thought comes, we must ask why. Why did this particular thought come now? How does it relate to my life questions? Taking this observer position helps us release our need to control everything. It places us in the flow of evolution.
But what about negative thoughts, I asked. Those fear images of something bad happening, such as someone we love getting hurt, or of not achieving something we very much want.
Very simple, Pablo said. The Seventh Insight says that fear images should be halted as soon as they come. Then, another image, one with a good outcome, should be willed through the mind. Soon, negative images will almost never happen. Your intuitions will be about positive things. When negative images come after that, the manuscript says they should be taken very seriously and not followed. For instance, if the idea comes to you that you're going to have a wreck in a truck and someone comes along and offers you a ride in a truck, then do not accept it.
We had come full circle in our walk around the courtyard and were approaching the guard. Neither of us talked as we passed him. Pablo picked a flower and I took a deep breath. The air was warm and humid,
and the plant life outside the wall was dense and tropical. I had noticed several mosquitoes.
Come,
the soldier suddenly called out. He prodded us inside and down to our cell. Pablo entered ahead of me, but the soldier put his arm up, blocking my way.
Not you,
he said, then nodded for me to walk down the hallway and up the other steps and outside through the same door we had entered the night before. In the parking lot, Father Sebastian was entering the back seat of a large car. A driver shut the door behind him. For an instant, Sebastian looked at me again, then he turned and said something to the driver. The car sped away. The soldier nudged me toward the front of the building. We walked inside and into an office. I was directed to sit in a wooden chair across from a white metal desk. Within minutes, a small, sandy-haired priest of about 30 entered and sat at the desk without acknowledging my presence. He looked through a file for a full minute, then looked up at me. His round, gold-rimmed glasses produced an intellectual appearance.
You've been arrested with illegal state documents, he said matter-of-factly. I'm here to help determine whether prosecution is in order. I would appreciate your cooperation.
I nodded.
Where did you get the translations?
I don't understand, I said. Why would copies of an old manuscript be illegal?
The government of Peru has its reasons, he said. Please answer the question.
Why is the church involved? I asked.
Because this manuscript contradicts the traditions of our religion, he said. It misrepresents the truth of our spiritual nature, where...
Look, I said, interrupting. I'm just trying to understand this. I'm just a tourist who got interested in this manuscript. I'm a threat to no one. I only want to know why it is so alarming. He looked puzzled, as if trying to decide the best strategy for dealing with me. I was consciously pressing for details.
The church feels the manuscript is confusing to our people, he said carefully. It gives the impression that people can decide on their own how to live, without regard to the scriptures.
Which scriptures?
The commandment to honor thy father and mother, for one.
What do you mean?
The manuscript blames problems on parents, undermining the family.
I thought it spoke of ending old resentments, I said, and finding a positive view of our early life.
No, he said. It is misleading. There should never have been a negative feeling to begin with.
Can't parents be wrong?
Parents do the best they can. Children must forgive them.
But isn't that what the manuscript is clarifying? Doesn't forgiveness take place when we see the positive about our childhoods? His voice rose with anger.
But from what authority does this manuscript speak? How can it be trusted?
He walked around the desk and stared down at me, still angry.
You don't know what you're talking about, he said. Are you a religious scholar? I think not. You're direct evidence of the kind of confusion this manuscript evokes. Don't you understand that there is order in the world only because of law and authority? How can you question the authorities in this matter?
I said nothing, which seemed to infuriate him even more.
Let me tell you something, he said. The crime you have committed is punishable by years in prison. Have you ever been in a Peruvian prison? Does your Yankee curiosity yearn to find out what our prisons are like? I can arrange that. Do you understand? I can arrange that.
He put his hand over his eyes and paused, taking a deep breath, obviously trying to calm down.
I am here to find out who has copies, where they are coming from. I will ask you one more time. Where did you get your translations?
His outburst had filled me with anxiety. I was making my situation worse with all my questions. What might he do if I failed to cooperate? Still, how could I implicate Father Sanchez and Father Carl? I need some time to think before I answer you, I said. Momentarily, he looked as if he might fly into another rage. Then he relaxed and looked very tired.
I will give you until tomorrow morning, he said, motioning for the soldier standing in the doorway to take me away.
I followed the soldier back down the hall and directly to the cell. Without saying anything, I walked over and lay down on my cot, feeling exhausted myself. Pablo was looking out the barred window.
Did you talk to Father Sebastian?
He asked. No, it was another priest. He wanted to know who gave me the copies I had.
What did you say?
Nothing. I asked for time to think and he gave me until tomorrow.
Did he say anything about the manuscript?
Pablo asked. I looked into Pablo's eyes, and this time he did not lower his head. He talked a little about how the manuscript undermines traditional authority, I said. Then he started raving and threatening me. Pablo looked genuinely surprised.
Did he have brown hair and round glasses?
Yes.
His name is Father Costos, Pablo said. What else did you say?
I disagreed with him on whether the manuscript undermines tradition, I replied. He threatened me with prison. Do you think he meant that?
I don't know, Pablo said.
He walked over and sat on his cot across from me. I could tell he had something else on his mind, but I was so tired and scared that I closed my eyes. When I awoke, Pablo was shaking me.
Time for lunch, he said.
We followed a guard upstairs and were served a plate of gristly beef and potatoes. The two men who we saw earlier came in after us. Marjorie wasn't with them.
Where is Marjorie?
I asked them, trying to whisper. The two men looked horrified that I would speak to them, and the soldiers stared at me intensely.
I don't think they speak English, Pablo said.
I wonder where she is, I said.
Pablo said something in response, but again, I wasn't listening. I suddenly felt like running away, and was picturing myself fleeing down a street of some kind, then ducking through a doorway to freedom.
What are you thinking about? Pablo asked.
I was fantasizing about an escape, I said.
What were you saying?
Wait, Pablo said. Don't dismiss your thought. It may be important. What kind of escape?
I was running down an alley or a street, then through a doorway. I got the impression I was successfully escaping.
What do you think of this image? Pablo asked.
I don't know, I said. It didn't seem to be logically connected to what we were talking about.
Do you remember what we were talking about?
Yes, I was asking about Marjorie.
You don't think there is a connection between Marjorie and your thought?
Not an obvious link I can think of.
What about a hidden link?
I can't see a connection. How could escaping be related to Marjorie?
Do you think she escaped?
He looked thoughtful.
Your thought was of you escaping.
Oh, yeah, that's right, I said. Maybe I'm going to escape without her. I looked at him. Maybe I'm going to escape with her.
That would be my guess, he said.
But where is she?
I don't know.
We finished eating without talking. I was hungry, but the food seemed too heavy. For some reason, I felt tired and sluggish. My hunger left me quickly. I noticed Pablo wasn't eating either.
I think we should go back to the cell, Pablo said.
I nodded, and he motioned for the soldier to take us back. When we arrived, I stretched out on my cot, and Pablo sat looking at me.
Your energy seems down, he said.
It is, I replied. I'm not sure what is wrong.
Are you trying to take in energy?
He asked. I guess I haven't, I replied. And that food doesn't help.
But you don't need much food if you are taking everything in.
He swept his arm in front of him to emphasize everything. I know. It's hard for me to get the love flowing in a situation like this. He looked at me quizzically.
But not to do so is to harm yourself.
What do you mean?
Your body is vibrating at a certain level. If you let your energy get too low, your body suffers. That is the relationship between stress and disease. Love is the way we keep our vibration up. It keeps us healthy. It is that important.
Give me a few minutes, I said. I practiced the method Father Sanchez had taught me. Immediately I felt better. The objects around me stood out with presence. I closed my eyes and concentrated on the feeling.
That's good, he said.
I opened my eyes and saw him smiling broadly at me. His face and body were still boyish and immature, but his eyes now seemed full of wisdom.
I can see the energy coming into you, he said.
I could detect a slight field of green around Pablo's body. The new flowers he had placed in the vase on the table seemed radiant.
To grasp the seventh insight and truly enter the movement of evolution, he said, one must pull all the insights into one way of being.
I didn't say anything.
Can you sum up how the world has changed for you as a result of the insights?
I thought for a moment. I guess I've woken up and seen the world as a mysterious place that provides everything we need if we get clear and get on the path.
Then what happens?
He asked. Then we're ready to begin the evolutionary flow.
And how do we engage this process?
I thought for a moment. By keeping our current life questions firmly in mind, I said, and then watching for direction, either in a dream or in an intuitive thought, or in the way the environment illuminates and jumps out at us. I paused again, trying to pull the whole insight together, then added, we build our energy and center ourselves in our situations, in the questions we have. Then we receive some form of intuitive guidance, an idea of where to go or what to do, and then coincidences occur to allow us to move in that direction.
Yes, yes, Pablo said. That is the way. And each time that these coincidences lead us into something new, we grow. We become fuller persons, existing at a higher vibration.
He was leaning toward me, and I noticed the incredible energy around him. He was beaming, no longer appearing shy or even young. He seemed full of power. Pablo, what has happened to you? I asked. Compared to when I first met you, you seem more confident and knowledgeable and full somehow. He laughed.
When you first came, I had allowed my energy to dissipate. At first, I thought that you might be able to help me with my energy flow, but I realized that you haven't learned to do this yet. That ability is learned in the 8th insight.
I was puzzled. What was it that I didn't do?
You must learn that all the answers that mysteriously come to us really come from other people. Think about all that you have learned since you have been in Peru. Haven't all the answers come to you through the actions of other people you mysteriously met?
I thought about it. He was right. I had met just the right people at just the right time. Charlene, Dobson, Will, Dale, Marjorie, Phil, Reynaud, Father Sanchez, and Father Carl, now Pablo.
Even the manuscript was written by a person, Pablo added. But not all the people you meet will have the energy or the clarity to reveal the message they have for you. You must help them by sending them energy.
He paused.
You told me of learning to project your energy toward a plant by focusing on its beauty, remember?
Yes.
Well, you do exactly the same thing toward a person. When the energy goes into them, it helps them see their truth. Then they can give this truth to you. Father Costas is an example, he continued. He had an important message for you, which you did not help him reveal. You tried to demand answers from him, and that created a competition between you and him for energy. When he felt that, his childhood drama, his intimidator, took over the conversation.
What was I supposed to have said? I asked. Pablo didn't answer. Again, we heard someone at the cell door. Father Costas entered. He nodded at Pablo, a slight smile on his face. Pablo smiled broadly, as if he actually liked the priest. Father Costas shifted his gaze to me, his face becoming stern. Anxiety gripped my stomach.
Cardinal Sebastian has asked to see you, he said. You will be transported to Iquitos this afternoon. I would advise you to answer all his questions.
Why does he want me? I asked.
Because the truck you were caught with belongs to one of our priests. We are assuming you received your copies of the manuscript from him. For one of our own priests to disregard the law is very serious.
He looked at me with determination. I glanced at Pablo, who nodded for me to continue. You think that the manuscript is undermining your religion? I asked Costas gently. He looked at me with condescension.
Not just our religion, everyone's religion. Do you think there is no plan for this world? God is in control. He assigns our destiny. Our job is to obey the laws set forth by God. Evolution is a myth. God creates the future the way he wants it. To say humans can make themselves evolve takes the will of God out of the picture. It allows people to be selfish and separate. They think that their evolution is the important thing, not God's plan. They will treat each other even worse than they do now.
I couldn't think of another question. The priest looked at me for a moment, then said, almost kindly,
I hope you will cooperate with Cardinal Sebastian.
He turned and looked at Pablo, obviously proud of the way he had handled my questions. Pablo only smiled at him and nodded again. The priest walked out, and a soldier locked the door behind him. Pablo leaned forward on his cot and beamed at me, his demeanor still completely transformed, confidence on his face. I looked at him for a moment, then smiled.
What do you think happened just now? He asked.
I struggled for humor. I found out I'm in more trouble than I thought. He laughed,
What else occurred?
I'm not sure what you're getting at.
What were your questions when you arrived here?
I wanted to find Marjorie and Will.
Well, you found one of them. What was your other question?
I had a sense that these priests were against the manuscript, not out of malice, but because they misunderstood. I wanted to know what they were thinking. For some reason, I had the idea they could be talked out of their opposition. After saying this, I suddenly understood what Pablo was leading to. I had met Costas, here, now, so that I could find out what bothered him about the manuscript.
And what was the message you received? He asked.
The message?
Yes, the message.
I looked at him. It's the idea of participating in evolution that bothers them, isn't it?
Yes,
he said. That would figure, I added. The idea of physical evolution is bad enough, but to extend the idea to everyday life, to the individual decisions we make, to history itself? That's unacceptable. They think humans will run amok with this evolution, that relations between people will degenerate. No wonder they want to see the manuscript suppressed.
Could you convince them otherwise? Pablo asked.
No. I mean, I don't know enough myself.
What would it take for someone to be able to convince them?
One would have to know the truth. One would have to know how humans would be treating each other if everyone was following the insights and evolving. Pablo appeared pleased. What? I asked, smiling along with him.
How humans will act toward each other is in the very next insight, the eighth. Your question of why the priests were against the manuscript has been answered, and the answer, in turn, has evolved into another question.
Yes, I said, deep in thought. I've got to find the eighth. I've got to get out of here.
Don't go too fast, Pablo cautioned. You must make sure you fully grasp the seventh before you go further.
Do you think I grasp it? I asked. Am I staying in the flow of evolution?
You will, he said, if you remember to keep your questions always in mind. Even people who are still unaware can stumble into answers and see coincidences in retrospect. The seventh insight occurs when we can see these answers as they arrive. It heightens everyday experience. We must assume every event has significance and contains a message that somehow pertains to our questions. This especially applies to what we used to call bad things. The seventh insight says that the challenge is to find the silver lining in every event, no matter how negative. You first thought that being captured had ruined everything, but now you can see that you were supposed to be here. This is where your answers were.
He was right. But if I was receiving answers here and evolving to a higher level, then Pablo must certainly be doing the same thing. Suddenly, we heard someone coming down the hall. Pablo looked directly at me, a serious look on his face.
Listen, he said. Remember what I told you. The eighth insight is next for you. It is about an interpersonal ethic, a way of treating other people so more messages are shared. But remember not to go too fast. Stay centered in your situation. What are your questions?
I want to find out where Will is, I said, and I want to find the eighth insight, and I want to find Marjorie.
And what was your guiding intuition concerning Marjorie?
I thought for a moment. That I would escape, that we would escape. We could hear someone right outside the door. Did I bring you a message? I asked Pablo hurriedly.
Of course, he said. When you arrived, I didn't know why I was here. I knew it had something to do with communicating the seventh insight, but I doubted my ability. I didn't think that I knew enough. Because of you, he continued, I now know that I can. That was one of the messages that you brought to me.
Was there another?
Yes. Your intuition that the priest can be convinced to accept the manuscript is a message for me also. It makes me think I'm here to convince Father Costas.
As he finished speaking, a soldier opened the door and motioned for me. I looked at Pablo.
I want to tell you one of the concepts the next insight talks about, he said.
The soldier glared at him and took my arm, ushering me out the door and closing it. As I was led away, Pablo stared through the bars.
The eighth insight warns against something, he called out. It warns against your growth being stopped. It happens when you become addicted to another person.
The Interpersonal Ethic. I followed the soldier up the steps and out into the bright sunshine. Pablo's warning was echoing in my head. Addiction to another person? What did he mean by that? What kind of addiction? The soldier led me down the path toward the parking area, where two other soldiers stood beside a military jeep. They watched us intensely as we walked their way. When I was close enough to see inside the jeep, I noticed that a passenger was already sitting in the back. Marjorie. She looked pale and anxious. Before I could catch her eye, the soldier behind me grabbed my arm and directed me into the seat beside her. Two other soldiers climbed into the front seats. The one sitting on the driver's side glanced back at us briefly. Then he started the vehicle and headed north. "Do you speak English?" I asked the soldiers. The soldier in the passenger seat, a beefy man, looked at me blankly and said something in Spanish that I couldn't understand, then turned curtly away. I turned my attention to Marjorie. "Are you all right?" I asked in a whisper. Her voice faded, and I noticed tears were flowing down her face. "It's going to be okay," I said, putting my arm around her. She looked up at me, then rested her head on my shoulder. A ripple of passion filled my body. For an hour, we bounced along the unpaved road. Outside, the landscape grew continuously more lush and jungle-like. Then, around one bend, the dense vegetation opened up into what appeared to be a small town. Wood frame buildings lined both sides of the road. 100 yards ahead, a large truck blocked the way. Several soldiers motioned for us to stop. Beyond them were other vehicles, some with flashing yellow lights. I became more alert. As we pulled to a stop, one of the soldiers outside walked up and said something I couldn't understand. The only word I recognized was gasoline. Our escorts left the jeep and stood outside talking with the other soldiers. They glanced at us occasionally, weapons at their side. I noticed a small street which angled to the left. As I looked at the shops and doorways, something changed in my perception. The shapes and colors of the buildings suddenly stood out and became more distinct. I whispered Marjorie's name and felt her look up, but before she could say anything, an enormous explosion rocked the jeep. A blast of fire and light shot up from the area in front of us, and the soldiers were blown to the ground. Immediately, our vision was obscured by smoke and falling ash. "Come on!" I yelled, pulling Marjorie from the vehicle. Amid the confusion, we ran down the street in the direction I had been looking. Behind us, I could hear distant shouts and moans. Still engulfed with smoke, we ran perhaps 50 yards. Suddenly, I noticed a doorway to the left. "In here!" I shouted. The door was open and we both ran inside. I fell against the door, closing it securely. When I turned around, I saw a middle-aged woman staring at us. We had dashed into someone's home. As I looked at her, attempting a smile, I noticed that the woman's expression was not one of horror, nor anger, at having had two strangers rush into her house after an explosion. Instead, what she displayed was an amused half-smile that looked more like resignation, as though she half expected us and now had to do something. On a chair nearby was a small child about 4 years old.
"Hurry," she said in English. "They will be looking for you."
She ushered us to the back of the sparsely furnished living room, through a hall, and down some wooden steps to a long cellar. The child walked at her side. We moved quickly through the cellar and up some other steps to an outside door leading to an alley. The woman unlocked a small, compact car which was parked there and hurried us inside. She directed us to lie down in the back seat, threw a blanket over us, and pulled away in what seemed to be a northerly direction. Through it all, I remained speechless, carried along by the woman's initiative. A rush of energy filled my body as I fully realized what had happened. My intuition of escape had occurred. Marjorie lay beside me, her eyes tightly closed. "Are you all right?" I whispered. She looked up at me with tearful eyes and nodded. After about 15 minutes, the woman said, "I think you can sit up now." I pushed away the blanket and looked around. We seemed to be on the same road as before the explosion, only farther north. "Who are you?" I asked. She turned and looked at me with her half-smile. She was a shapely woman of about 40 with shoulder-length dark hair. "I'm Carla Dees," she said. "This is my daughter, Maretta." The child was smiling and looking over the passenger seat at us with large, inquisitive eyes. Her hair was jet black and also long. I told them who we were, then asked, "How did you know to help us?" Carla's smile grew wider.
You are running from the soldiers because of the manuscript, aren't you?
Yes, but how did you know?
I know the manuscript, too.
Where are you taking us? I asked.
I don't know that, she said. You will have to help me.
I glanced at Marjorie. She was watching me closely as I spoke. Right now, I don't know where to go, I said. Before I was captured, I was trying to get to Iquitos.
Why did you want to go there? She asked.
I'm trying to find a friend. He's looking for the Ninth Insight.
That is a dangerous thing.
I know.
We will take you there, won't we, Moretta?
The little girl giggled and said with a sophistication beyond her years,
Of course.
What kind of explosion was that back there? I asked.
I think it was a gas truck, she answered. Earlier, an accident had occurred, a leak.
I was still amazed at how quickly Carla had decided to help us, so I decided to press the question. How did you know we were running from the soldiers?
She took a deep breath. Yesterday, many military trucks were passing through the village going north. This is unusual, and it made me think of the time 2 months ago when my friends were taken away. My friends and I studied the manuscript together. We were the only ones in this village who had all 8 insights. Then the soldiers came and took my friends. I have not heard from them. As I watched the trucks yesterday, she continued, I knew the soldiers were continuing to hunt copies of the manuscript and that others, like my friends, would need help. I envisioned myself helping those people if I could. Of course, I suspected that it was meaningful that I was having that particular thought at that particular time. So when you came into my house, I was not surprised.
She paused, then asked, Have you ever experienced this?
Yes, I said.
Carla slowed the car. Ahead was a crossroads.
I think we should turn to the right here, she said. It will take longer, but it will be safer.
As Carla turned the car to the right, Moretta slid to the left and had to hold onto the seat to keep from falling over. She giggled. Marjorie was staring appreciatively at the little girl.
How old is Moretta?
Marjorie asked Carla.
Carla looked disturbed, then said gently, Please don't talk about her as if she wasn't here. If she was an adult, you would have addressed the question to her.
Oh, I'm sorry, Marjorie said.
I'm 5,
Moretta said proudly.
Have you studied the 8th insight? Carla asked.
No,
Marjorie said. I've only seen the 3rd insight.
I'm at the 8th, I said. Do you have any copies?
No, Carla said. All the copies were taken away by the soldiers.
Does the 8th talk about how to relate to children?
Yes, it is about how humans will eventually learn to relate to each other and talks of many things, such as how to project energy to others and how to avoid addictions to people.
There was that warning again.
I was about to ask Carla what it meant when Marjorie spoke. Tell us about the 8th insight, she said.
The 8th insight, Carla explained, is about using energy in a new way when relating to people in general, but it begins at the beginning with children. How should we view children? I asked.
We should view them as they really are, as endpoints in evolution that lead us forward. But in order to learn to evolve, they need our energy on a constant basis, unconditionally. The worst thing that can be done to children is to drain their energy while correcting them. This is what creates control dramas in them, as you already know. But these learned manipulations on the child's part can be avoided if the adults give them all the energy they need, no matter what the situation. That is why they should always be included in conversations, especially conversations about them. And you should never take responsibility for more children than you can give attention to.
The manuscript says all this? I asked.
Yes, she said, and the point about the number of children is highly stressed.
I felt confused. Why is the number of children one has important? She glanced at me for an instant as she drove.
Because any one adult can only focus on and give attention to one child at a time. If there are too many children for the number of adults, then the adults become overwhelmed and unable to give enough energy. The children begin to compete with each other for the adults' time.
Sibling rivalry, I said.
Yes, but the manuscript says that this problem is more important than people think. Adults often glamorize the idea of large families and children growing up together, but children should learn the world from adults, not from other children. In too many cultures, children are running in gangs. The manuscript says humans will slowly understand that they should not bring children into the world unless there is at least one adult
committed to focus full attention all of the time on each child.
But wait a minute, I said. In many situations, both parents must work to survive. This denies them the right to have children.
Not necessarily, she replied. The manuscript says humans will learn to extend their families beyond blood ties, so that someone else is able to provide one-on-one attention. All the energy does not have to come from the parents alone. In fact, it is better if it does not. But whoever cares for the children must provide this one-on-one attention.
Well, I said, you've done something right. Moretta certainly seems mature.
Carla frowned and said, Don't tell me, tell her.
Oh, right. I looked at the child. You act very grown up, Moretta. She looked away shyly for a moment, then said,
Thank you.
Carla hugged her warmly.
Carla looked at me proudly.
For the last 2 years, I have been trying to relate to Moretta according to the manuscript's guidelines, haven't I, Moretta?
The child smiled and nodded.
I have tried to give her energy and to always tell her the truth of every situation in language she can understand. When she asked the questions a young child asks, I treated them very seriously, avoiding the temptation of giving her a fanciful answer, which is plainly for the entertainment of adults.
I smiled. Do you mean untruths like, storks bring babies, that sort of thing?
Yes, but these cultural expressions aren't so bad. Children figure these out quickly because they stay the same. Worse are the distortions created on the spot by adults just because they want to have a little fun, and because they believe the truth is too complicated for a child to comprehend. But this is not right. The truth can always be expressed at a child's level of understanding. It just takes some thought.
What does the manuscript say about this issue?
It says we should always find a way to tell a child the truth.
Part of me resisted this idea. I was one who enjoyed kidding around with children. Don't kids usually understand that adults are just playing? I said. All this seems to make them grow up too fast and take some of the fun out of childhood. She looked at me sternly.
Moretta is full of fun. We chase and tumble and play all the childhood fantasy games. The difference is that when we are fantasizing, she knows it.
I nodded. She was right, of course.
Moretta seems confident, Carla continued, because I was there for her. I gave her one-on-one attention when she needed it. And if I wasn't there, my sister, who lives next door, was there. She always had an adult to answer her questions, and because she has had this sincere attention, she has never felt she had to act out or show off. She has always had enough energy, and that makes her assume she will continue to have enough, which makes the transition from receiving energy from adults to getting it from the universe, which we already talk about, much easier for her to grasp.
I noticed the terrain outside. We were traveling through deep jungle now, and though I couldn't see it, I knew the sun was low in the afternoon sky. Can we get to Iquitos tonight? I asked.
No, Carla said, but we can stay at a house I know.
Near here? I asked.
Yes, it is the house of a friend. He works for the Wildlife Service.
He works for the government?
Some of the Amazon is a protected area. He is the local agent, but influential. His name is Juan Hinton. Do not worry. He believes in the manuscript, and they have never bothered him.
By the time we arrived, the sky was completely dark. Around us, the jungle was alive with night sounds, the air muggy. A large, well-lit wood frame house stood at the end of a clearing in the dense foliage. Nearby were two large buildings and several jeeps. Another vehicle was up on blocks, and two men worked around lights underneath. A thin Peruvian, dressed in expensive clothing, answered Carla's knock and smiled at her until he noticed Marjorie, Moretta, and myself waiting on the steps. His face turned nervous and displeased as he talked to her in Spanish. She said something pleadingly in return, but his mannerism and inflection indicated that he did not want us to stay. Then, through the crack in the door, I noticed a lone female figure standing in the foyer. I moved a little to bring her face into view. It was Julia. As I looked, she turned her head and saw me, then quickly walked forward with a surprised look on her face. She touched the shoulder of the man at the door and said something quietly into his ear. The man nodded, then opened the door with a look of resignation. We all introduced ourselves as Hinton led the way into the den area. Julia looked at me and said, We meet again. She wore khaki pants with pockets on the legs and a bright red t-shirt. Yes, we do, I said. A Peruvian servant stopped Hinton
and after talking for a minute, the two walked into another part of the house. Julia sat in a chair by a coffee table and motioned for the rest of us to sit on a couch across from her. Marjorie appeared panicked. She looked at me intensely. Carla also seemed to be aware of Marjorie's distress. She walked over and took her by the hand. "Let's get some hot tea," she suggested. As they walked away, Marjorie glanced back at me. I smiled and watched them until they turned the corner into the kitchen. Then I turned to face Julia.
"So what do you think it means?" she asked.
"What does what mean?" I replied, still distracted.
"That we have run into each other again."
I don't know.
"How did you wind up with Carla, and where are you going?"
"She saved us. Marjorie and I had been detained by Peruvian troops. When we escaped, she happened to be there to help us." Julia looked intense.
"Tell me what occurred."
I leaned back and told her the whole story, beginning at the point in which I had taken Father Carl's truck, and then all about the capture and our eventual escape.
"And Carla agreed to take you to Iquitos?" Julia asked.
"Yes."
"Why do you want to go there?"
"That's where Will told Father Carl he was going. Will apparently has a lead about the Ninth Insight. Also, Sebastian is there for some reason." Julia nodded.
"Yes, Sebastian has a mission near there. It's where he made his reputation, converting the Indians."
"What about you?" I asked. "What are you doing here?" Julia told me that she too wanted to find the Ninth Insight, but that she had no leads. She had come to this house after thinking repeatedly of her old friend, Hinton. I was hardly listening. Marjorie and Carla had walked out of the kitchen and were standing in the hall talking, cups of tea in their hands. Marjorie caught my eye, but said nothing.
"Has she read much of the manuscript?"
Julia asked, nodding toward Marjorie. "Just the third insight," I said.
"We can probably get her out of Peru, if that's what she wants."
I turned and looked at her.
"How?" "Rolando is leaving tomorrow for Brazil. We have some friends at the American embassy there. They can get her back to the United States. We have helped other Americans this way."
I looked at her and nodded tentatively. I realized I was having mixed feelings about what she had said. Part of me knew that leaving would be best for Marjorie, but another part wanted her to stay, to remain with me. I felt changed, energized when she was around. "I think I need to talk with her," I finally said.
"Of course," Julia replied. "We can talk later."
I got up and walked toward her. Carla was heading back toward the kitchen. Marjorie stepped around the corner of the hall, out of sight. When I walked up, she was leaning back against the wall. I pulled Marjorie into my arms. My body pulsated. "Feel that energy?" I asked, whispering into her ear.
"It's incredible," she said. "What does it mean?"
"I don't know. We have some kind of connection." I glanced around. No one could see us. We kissed, passionately. When I pulled back to look at her face, she looked different, stronger somehow, and I thought back to the day we had met at Vicente and to the conversation in the restaurant at Cula. I couldn't believe the amount of energy I felt in her presence and when she touched me. She held me tightly.
"Since that day at Vicente," she said, "I've wanted to be with you. I didn't know what to think about it then, but the energy is wonderful. I've never experienced anything like this."
Out of the corner of my eye, I noticed Carla walking up, smiling. She told us that dinner was ready, so we made our way into the dining room and found a huge buffet of fresh fruits and vegetables and breads. Everyone served their plates and sat around a large table. After Moretta sang a blessing song, we spent an hour and a half eating and talking casually. Hinton had lost his nervousness, and he set a light-hearted mood which helped to ease the tension of our escape. Marjorie was talking freely and laughing. Sitting beside her filled me with warm love. After dinner, Hinton took us back into the den where a custard dessert was served with a sweet liqueur. Marjorie and I sat on the couch and fell into a long conversation about our pasts and significant life experiences. We seemed to grow closer and closer. The only difficulty we discovered was that she lived on the West Coast and I resided in the South. Later, Marjorie dismissed the problem and laughed heartily.
"I can't wait until we get back to the United States," she said. "We'll have so much fun traveling back and forth."
I sat back and gave her a serious look. "Julia said she could arrange a way for you to go home now."
"You mean both of us, don't you?"
she replied. "No, I can't go."
"Why?"
she asked.
I can't leave without you. But I can't stand to stay here any longer either. I'll go crazy.
You'll have to go on ahead. I'll be able to leave soon.
No, she said loudly. I can't stand that.
Carla, who was walking back into the den from putting Moretta in bed, glanced toward us, then looked quickly away. Hinton and Julia were still talking, seemingly oblivious to Marjorie's outburst.
Please, Marjorie said, let's just go home.
I looked away.
Okay, fine, she said. Stay.
She stood and walked briskly toward the bedroom area. My gut wrenched as I watched Marjorie walk away. The energy I had gained with her collapsed, and I suddenly felt weak and confused. I tried to shake it off. After all, I told myself, I hadn't known her that long. On the other hand, I thought, maybe she was correct. Maybe I should just go home. What difference could I make here anyway? Back at home, I could perhaps marshal some support for the manuscript and stay alive as well. I stood up and started to follow her down the hall, but for some reason, I sat back down. I couldn't decide what to do.
May I join you for a minute?
Carla was suddenly asking. I hadn't noticed that she was standing beside the sofa. Sure, I said. She sat down and looked at me with regard.
I couldn't help overhearing what is going on, she said, and I thought that before you made your decision, you might want to hear what the Eighth Insight says about addictions to people.
Yes, please, I want to know what that means.
When one first learns to be clear and to engage one's evolution, any of us can be stopped, suddenly, by an addiction to another person.
You're speaking of Marjorie and me, aren't you?
Let me explain the process, she said, and you judge for yourself.
Okay.
First, let me say that I had a very hard time with this part of the insight. I don't think I would have ever understood if I had not met Professor Raynaud.
Raynaud? I exclaimed.
I know him. We met when I was learning the Fourth Insight. Well, she said, we met when we both had reached the Eighth Insight. He stayed at my house for several days.
I nodded in amazement.
He said that the idea of an addiction, as used in the manuscript, explains why power struggles arise in romantic relationships. We've always wondered what causes the bliss and euphoria of love to end, to suddenly turn into conflict, and now we know. It is a result of the flow of energy between the individuals involved. When love first happens, the two individuals are giving each other energy unconsciously, and both people feel buoyant and elated. That's the incredible high we all call being in love. Unfortunately, once they expect this feeling to come from the other person, they cut themselves off from the energy in the universe and begin to rely even more on the energy from each other. Only now, there doesn't seem to be enough, and so they stop giving each other energy and fall back into their dramas in an attempt to control each other and force the other